Welcome to the Federal Society Practice Group podcast. This is the Free Speech and Election Law podcast. Our practice group is hosting a panel today on the U.S. Supreme Court case Doe v. Reed and the role of anonymity in a democracy. As always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions here today are of the opinions of the speakers, not of the Federal Society. My name is Allison Hayward. I am a campaign finance and election law specialist here in Washington, D.C., and the chair of the Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group. Now, the Supreme Court recently heard oral argument in Doe v. Reed. It was a case involving a Washington state law that would disclose, on request, the identities of individuals who signed a referendum petition. In this case, we had a controversial referendum. The referendum was to reject a legislative decision furthering the rights of same-sex couples. So the anonymity was in the context of something that is hotly debated and contested. Today we have talking about Doe v. Reed, and first off the bat, Robert Frommer. He's a staff attorney with the Institute for Justice, and the Institute for Justice filed an amicus brief in Doe v. Reed, a friend of the court brief, arguing that disclosure was inappropriate. We also have with us today John Fortier, who's a research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and he specializes in American government and political reform. So I'm going to start with you, Robert. Can you give us a sense of the, you know, maybe some more details from the case and what your perspective is on disclosure in this context?
Sure. Thank you, Allison. The only thing you should need in order to speak out about politics is an opinion. But unfortunately, the mandatory disclosure law that was at issue in Doe v. Reed forced people to name names as a condition of participating in politics. Now, Doe v. Reed, as you mentioned, is about the Washington State Public Records Act. And the question is whether Washington State may constitutionally release the names and addresses of over 100,000 people who signed a petition to put a referendum on the November 2009 ballot. For over 30 years, the Washington Secretary of State interpreted the Public Records Act not to require the disclosure of this information. And it said that precisely because it feared chilling citizen speech and political participation. Now, after a change in opinion, in order to intimidate their political opponents, several groups named WhoSigned.org and KnowThyNeighbor.org want the names and addresses of everyone who signed a petition to put this referendum on the ballot. Their plans? Well, that's to post all this information on the internet, everyone's name and address on the internet, in the hopes of sparking personal and uncomfortable conversations. That's what they have written in their press releases. Now, mandatory disclosure laws, like Washington's, are widespread, and they exist in every state that has initiatives and referenda. Part of the reason that these laws exist is because courts have historically assumed that the laws impose few, if any, costs on political speech. But that was really an assumption. Until the Institute first researched the issue for a publication back in 2007, no one had actually tested this. So IJ surveyed 2,000 people in six different states, and what it found was striking. While most people said they supported disclosure generally, that support evaporated as soon as they were faced with the prospect of having their own information made public. In fact, it was so bad that 3 out of 5 people who were surveyed said they would think twice about donating to a ballot issue campaign if that meant the state would disclose their name and addresses to the public. When they were asked why they would refrain from giving, people most often said they wanted to keep their involvement anonymous. They are also afraid that having their personal information published could threaten privacy, their personal safety, and even their job. Now, it turns out that that's not just sort of a theoretical concern. It's actually quite real. California, for instance, is one of the many states that requires people to disclose their contributions to groups that talk about ballot issues. During the Proposition 8 debate in California in 2008, donors' information was collected by the state, disclosed to the public, and put up on the internet. As a result, there were a widespread number of death threats, physical violence, vandalism, and economic reprisals. A woman who managed a restaurant in L.A. lost her job after people found out that a $100 contribution she made to the Prop 8 committee, after they found out about it, and they threatened boycotts. In another instance, a theater director had to resign after controversy surrounded his contribution to a group. So making petition signers and people who donate to ballot issue committees reveal themselves and name names to the entire world means that, in reality, many of them will stay silent, often out of fear of intimidation and harassment. Here, the key lesson is that the government must always tread lightly in order to ensure that when it's carrying out its necessary functions, it doesn't burden the right to speech and privacy any more than is absolutely necessary. But Washington's disclosure law is a heavy-handed tool that serves no legitimate government interest. The so-called informational interest in knowing who signed a petition is really just the bare desire to know who is saying what about politics, about ballot issues, and it's an interest that the Supreme Court squarely rejected in McIntyre versus Ohio Election Commission. And while the state of Washington might have an interest in maintaining the integrity of its referendum process and protecting against fraud, it can do that in ways that are far more narrowly tailored and far less destructive of free speech.
Okay, Robert. Now I want to turn to John Fortier here. John, the issue of identifying participants in politics comes up in a variety of other contexts, not just the petition case in Doe v. Reed. I know you've written some on anonymity and the secret ballot in voting, but there's also campaign finance disclosure and other places where anonymity is compromised for other state interests. What's your position in general on anonymity in a democracy and in politics?
Thank you, Allison, and I appreciate you having me here, partly because, I, as you said, I did begin thinking about this in the context of the Australian ballot, the secret ballot, and voting, and in particular, our move to voting in different ways, to voting a lot by mail, for example, in many states, where some of the concerns we had about a secret ballot are, I think, being forgotten by many states who are moving to a kind of convenience voting by mail, encouraging their citizens to vote in a way where a ballot leaves the ballot voting booth and ultimately has not the same privacy protections as at the voting booth. So I begin with a kind of very strong feeling that we are starting to forget and lose some of what we gained in the movement in the late 19th century to move towards the secret ballot. But I came to this trying to think, well, what are the levels of thought on this? Why do we protect voting at the ballot box and anonymity at the ballot box? And what are the sort of secondary and tertiary activities that we might protect some aspects of anonymity, but maybe wouldn't be quite as strong about as feeling about the ballot box? And so here are my thoughts about the ballot box. And here I guess I have to admit feeling quite strong about this. Certainly, we did not have the secret ballot from the beginning, and certainly Doe v. Reed gets into this question of whether it is actually unconstitutional to not have a secret ballot. Certainly, for many years we did not, and there is the very traditional argument that even in voting, one should stand up and be counted. If one's part of a community, one thinks of the New England style town meetings where everyone participates in a kind of direct democracy way, there is even in voting some case to be made that you should stand up and have your fellow citizens see how you vote. Ultimately, we chose not to go that way, partly, of course, for very practical reasons, and the biggest one being coercion, that the coercion of the vote, the ability of not only other individuals, but especially strong groups, political machines in cities and others who have great control over a number of citizens, being able to directly control the votes of a number of citizens, we thought was, too much, and we needed to give the voter anonymity. We needed to break the link between the voter and the pressures that the voter faces on the outside. So I asked the question, if that's a near absolute for us, what about some of these secondary activities? And here I think both in the question of disclosure of your donations, your political contributions, and here in the case of petitions, we have kind of a middle case, and I'm a little reluctant to go as far as Robert in granting the anonymity, although I see, of course, you know, some of the bad effects of not having it, and think there should be some avenues to address them. I think you could think of both of the nominating petitions and the giving of money for political candidates or political campaigns as a kind of nominating process. In voting, we have representation, where voters are somewhat anonymous, but our representatives are small in number and are asked to be on the record and can be voted out of office based on their roll call votes. But here we have, in the case of a petition, a nominating group, a smaller group. Robert mentions 100,000. That's a fairly large number, but certainly a lot less than those who might go to the polls in a general election. We do want some legitimacy. We want a number of people who are willing to stand up and say, this is important enough to bypass the legislative process and to put it on the ballot. It might be the case that a large group of people anonymously want to do this, but I think it's worthwhile to think that if something is important enough to be on the ballot, at least some people should stand up and say so, and say so in their own names. And I think that's also the case with donations, which again are a smaller group. There are some practical reasons why the state would want to know who contributed, but I think there's also a value in saying, look, this is not the final vote, right? This is not the representatives in Congress casting their votes, and yet it's also not something that we ask people to be completely anonymous about. We want some aspect of democracy to be standing up and saying what you're for, and I think that the petitions fall somewhere in between. And we certainly do have a case and some procedures for dealing with the more extreme versions where there's a particularly unpopular cause, and we understand that there might be violence against groups who propose it. We are concerned with protecting the speech rights of those particularly unpopular groups, but I worry in this case that we're probably extending this to essentially all referenda, and therefore lumping in the 95% of cases which are not that sort of case. And I do think it's worthwhile talking about whether there are any particular remedies that might be introduced in a public policy way in between. Certainly just suppressing the list and not allowing a list to get out there is one remedy, but one might also consider maybe in advance that there might be particular topics that would be of great import, and maybe there would be a way of petitioning to be in that category, to say this is a particularly controversial topic, we know it's going to be a problem, and therefore maybe this one would be secret. But I think we're lumping in an awful lot of general interest referenda, ones that many people are willing to publicly, in a sense, sign and stand up for, with the few cases that are particularly egregious that Robert mentioned.
Okay. Well, Robert, I want to sort of touch on something that John mentioned, and that also seemed to be something that Justice Scalia was advocating in oral argument. I mean, Justice Scalia, contrary to I think maybe what some people would expect, was very skeptical at oral argument of the argument that was being made that the anonymity was important. He sort of had this attitude that if you're going to be part of the public that wants to revisit state legislation, then you ought to be able to bear the sharp elbows of politics and get in there and not be too delicate about it. I'm just paraphrasing. That's not how he said it. He said it much more eloquently than I ever could.
I think you said something about civic courage.
Yeah, civic courage. So, Robert, what's wrong with expecting that the people who want to second-guess the elected legislature of the state of Washington on this legislation show some civic courage?
The problem is, though, that mandatory disclosure imposes real costs about speaking out on politics. And under our Constitution, when something burdens the First Amendment, it has to be justified by a compelling government interest. Here, there is no reason to mandate disclosure. The informational interest in simply knowing who is supporting a measure is simply just the bare desire to know who's supporting a measure. And if that's the reason, and this is something Justice Alito picked up on in his oral argument, if knowing someone's name and address is justified because of the wanting to know who supports a measure, why stop there? Why not ask about a person's religion, force them to disclose their religion or their ethnicity or a number of other factors that might be far more probative in explaining who is supporting an issue, but which no one, I think, would seriously contend should be permitted. The point is that we value political speech in our country, and mandatory disclosure laws impose real costs, and the more costs we put on political speech, the less we get. And to that extent, mandatory disclosure laws like Washington State's have no place in a nation that prides itself on free and unfettered political debate.
What I wonder, Robert, is if if this is just a matter of speaking out. I mean, there of course is the matter of putting yourself down on a piece of paper and saying you're in favor of essentially getting this on the ballot, and that is an act of speech in a way. You're making a statement of a sort, but you're also part of a process, part of a public process, part of a legislative process, getting something going to change the law. Certainly, there's no restriction on speaking out about the particular issue, and if you think of states that don't have a referendum process, or even the ones that do, and you want it to go through the regular legislative process, your speaking out would perhaps involve contacting a representative or having a demonstration or other ways of affecting that legislator. But ultimately, we do have, in that legislative process, we have some aspects of public actors putting themselves on the record. Those are the representatives. Because it's part of a political public process, it's partly speech, and it's partly that these signers of petitions are political actors. And I guess I'm trying to put them somewhere between voters and representatives, and think therefore some level of anonymity or some anonymity in some cases might be justified, but that in many cases we might value the fact that because this is a process outside the regular legislative process, we should have some people, indicating that they're acting as public actors and putting themselves on the record where they are.
Well, now it's important there is a speech act in signing the petition. That's true.
Right.
But there's also a whole separate speech act that's of critical importance in the petition process, which is those communications between the person collecting the signature, petition signatures, and potential signatories. There's a vast array of conversations there that take place. And the problem is that mandatory disclosure laws will force a large number of people to reflexively ignore, to reject any claims or any requests to engage in conversations from those petition gatherers. And so a large number of conversations are simply lost altogether. And that was an issue that the court noted. They noted in both, I think it was Meyer v. Grant and Buckley versus, in Buckley 2, Buckley versus American Constitutional, American
Constitution.
Yes, thank you, that there was this, the speech involved in the petition process is itself deserving of First Amendment protection, and that if you are going to impose laws that burden that speech, that will dissuade people from speaking, you have to have a real justification to do so. And simply the desire to have people stand up is not sufficient.
Okay, now I had a another question for John, prompted by some of the comments that he made. John, you were sort of working with the notion that a blanket rule about petition sign disclosure might not be appropriate, but you might be able to identify certain issues or certain contexts where more protection might be appropriate. I guess I'm wondering, should it matter how the people seeking disclosure want to use the information?
Meaning the essentially the state interest of how they want to use the or the people who would
yeah, this was a
get the information, the private groups who would get the information and then use it for their purposes. Which do
right.
you mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, the state has the petitions. The state has to look at the petitions to see if they're sufficiently valid signatures to make the referendum go forward. This is a Public Records Act question, though. This is a should it matter that the people who are seeking the petitions are seeking the petitions because they don't trust the state, the Secretary of State, to do a good job of verifying the petitions and want to do it themselves, versus, as here, a stated interest in, furthering a political agenda that's separate from the anti-fraud agenda the state might have.
Right. I mean, I certainly do think, one minimal purpose of requiring this is, of course, to see the certain percentage of citizens have put themselves see it sufficiently important to stand up and put themselves on the ballot, even if they did that anonymously, to say, hey, look, 10% of the people or 5% of the people think it's important enough to put on the ballot. We don't know who they are. We don't need to disclose who they are, but we need to count who they are, and that's a simple interest. I guess I wonder whether there isn't some other greater interest, and I do on your question of how people use it. I suppose that might come into a case by case judgment of whether a disclosure would make some sense, or even whether maybe there'd be types of petitions which would be applied for. I mean, maybe a group would say in advance, look, we think this issue is going to be controversial enough. We want to be anonymous. I think that would. Many people would view that negatively, and people would say, well, why do you want to keep that information secret? And it might be might affect the vote on...
Well, what do you have to hide?
Right. It might affect the vote
up.
On that. On the other hand, I think it's not a problem necessarily that there is some cost to that. If one had an avenue to do that, and people could judge at the end of the day, look, hey, it was done for... legitimate reasons. There's a silent majority out there. It's a politically incorrect issue that we understand. We're with the petitioners here, and we understand why they didn't want to put their names on that. I guess I'm supportive of that. I also think, look, it might depend a bit on how many signatures the state would require. If we're talking about a very significant number of signatures, you do start to approach the question of, well, maybe this is a mass thing that is more like voting, right? More like voting
and less like legislating.
Right. And I guess I still think of this as it's something of a nominating process. And mm-hmm. since you've cut the representatives out of it, since you've cut the regular legislative process out of this in a way, to have some sense that there's somebody on the record saying we make a case that this be on the ballot. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but the numbers, maybe the numbers would be would matter.
Well, let me pose a question to both of you that interests me anyway, and hopefully interests our listeners. Does the way the internet helps in the dissemination and manipulation of data broadly change the dynamics of this issue? And I ask that because, in Doe v. Reed, again, getting back to the goal of the people who sought disclosure, they didn't want just the paper petitions to look at. They were going to take the data and put it in a format where people could locate these people geographically who had signed the petitions and confront them. There's probably a small set of activists willing to engage in this kind of activity, but the fact that there are any at all, I think, is kind of worrisome to the people who don't want to have mean, nasty conversations with people in their neighborhood because of a fundamental disagreement over this particular part of social policy. So there you've got the internet, explicitly implicated in what this group wanted to do. But how about, federal and state, disclosure reports for campaign finance, at the $200 level? I'll go through this. I know you both know this, but some of our listeners may not. At the $200 threshold, the name, address, occupation, and employer of a donor to a federal campaign is disclosed to the FEC, but it's not just disclosed to the FEC, it's put up on the internet. And there's lots of groups out there who take this information and collect it and sort it, and so you can get, you know, geographically, you know, distinctive, you know, subsets of the data, and you can find out how your neighbors, you know, participate. State reports oftentimes you know, require itemization at even a lower level, $100 in California, which is where the Proposition 8 sort of information came from. You know, in some states, I think, still require first dollar disclosures. It means you give $5 to somebody, and, you know, your name is in some database someplace. It's fairly easy to access. Now, happily, many people in the United States have better things to do with their time than go through these reports and come up with nefarious, you know, agendas for, you know, disturbing these people. But, you know, how does the fact that this information isn't just available in the abstract, but available to everybody fairly easily, change the anonymity interest in the person that's participating? I'll go with Robert first. That was a long question, but you're very patient. So, Robert.
Well, I think that the internet has fundamentally changed the nature of disclosure. As you were saying, there's one committed activist or a small group of committed activists can take disclosure information and post it in a forum for all the world to see, and in a way that will lead people with a route of turn-by-turn direction to your house. We saw this in California with 8Maps. 8Maps is a clever, I guess, application which combined the state's public records information with a Google Map application. And the result was that you could look at a map of any particular city, and there'd be little pins of everyone who had contributed to the Prop 8, and you could see exactly where they lived. Also, on the Huffington Post, for instance, I believe there's a application that keeps track of this information of people's federal contributions. And oftentimes, the first, if you type someone's name into internet search engine, the first thing that pops up for them is a list of all their donations, including where they live. And so we know that
if you become a blogger, Google will scrape your blog first, and then that will be suppressed down further down the list. And so maybe I'm joking. what you're saying is, you know, this is there. It's there in perpetuity. It's not like it goes away at the end of the election. And
yeah,
it's very easy to manipulate. And so,
what happens
to the state interest here, Robert? I'm wondering.
Well, the state interest in the federal campaign is obviously different, or with federal contributions for candidates is obviously very different than with ballot issue contributions and with petitions. Because with candidates, obviously, there is at least some concern about corruption or the appearance for corruption. And in Buckley v. Vallejo, they said that the disclosure requirements for candidates are partially motivated by that. But in a ballot issue context, there is no candidate. There is no potential for corruption. The issue is what it is. It's what's written down on the paper. There's nothing that can be corrupted. And so I think when faced with this kind of real present threat to speech, that the bare informational interest that's present in the ballot issue context simply is just not sufficient.
Now, John, I want to give you an opportunity both to address my question about how, to what extent the internet changes things, but also, if you could touch on it just a minute, how about this assertion that there's no corruptive potential in ballot measure campaigns?
Sure. On the first question, I mean, I certainly agree that the internet has made things much easier to find people, to have groups organized and groups not necessarily even very close to where the campaign's going on, give information to those who would, you know, do some relatively nasty things to people who are signing petitions or making campaign contributions. I'm not sure that the ease of it, though, is going to justifies some of the remedies here. I mean, we certainly could see this in a number of other areas. If you are ever interviewed on television or a man on the street or come to a, you know, show up at a certain meeting at you know, private association meeting. It's not very hard for sometimes people to identify that you did this. And ultimately, even if you don't put the addresses next to someone, it's awfully easy for a group, for a sophisticated group like some of the ones mentioned in the case of Dovie Reed, to ultimately put the addresses with the people. Maybe there'll be some greater inaccuracies, and it's not right there in front of them. But the internet is going to allow a lot of people to organize against anything you say in any context. And while that may mean that you know, certain ones we're focusing on are public acts of petitions or giving campaign contributions, there are lots and lots of private acts that this sort of thing would also apply to. And so I guess my hope is that we would, you know, take more seriously the ways in which we look at groups that would organize against people to prevent them from doing things that they should be able to do. I mean, we have cases that are clearly criminal and cases that are clearly you know, a sort of organization inciting a kind of criminality. We have middle cases like boycotts, which the court has essentially upheld, which certainly involve some harm to the business, but also, you know, fall in this category of others being able to express themselves freely by withholding their purchases from a business, and, you know, protesting outside of someone's home. Well, you know, for public figures, we're more accepting of that, and for, you know, private figures, less so. So I think this should get us thinking much more about what we might do for all sorts of speech. But I worry now that we're focusing on these you know, pseudo public acts of petitions and campaign contributions, and sort of trying to make them completely anonymous and where much speech is out there.
If I could respond for a second,
Robert, go ahead.
Thank you. But the difference between some of the things that John listed, like writing, I don't know if you said letter to the editor or being a man on the street or going to a meeting, is those are all voluntary acts. Like you have decided.
Well, so is signing a petition, right? Isn't signing a petition a voluntary act? And so is
it's a voluntary act. But the question is, does the state have the power to force you to reveal yourself? Does if you have chosen to expose yourself to the public by being the man on the street? You know, I got in front of a TV camera. It's pretty clear that I'm going to be, you know, people are going to see me on the TV. Here, I'm signing a petition. The question is whether the state has the authority, has the power, or should have the right to say, because you did that, whether or not you want everybody to know you did this, we're going to force your information out there so that everybody can see it. And I think those are fundamentally different questions. And as to the boycott question, there's obviously nothing wrong with a boycott. Boycotts are constitutionally protected, and they're fine. The question is whether the state has the authority to say to force you to turn over your information to the would-be boycotters, to say that you, in order to participate in politics, in order to speak out, you have to give the people who want to boycott you the information and means by which they can do that. And I think that has to be subject to really searching review under the First Amendment, because the really worrisome chilling effect that could have on people's speech.
Well, now, Robert, I guess what I'm sort of concerned about, though, is maybe another point in this, which is, you know, in the petition context, you've got, you know, what John, I think, has appropriately characterized as something in between voting and legislating, where you've got one side petitioning. It's not like, in some ways, it's not like the campaign finance context, where each side gets to see the other's supporters. Here, the people who were opposed to the referendum could get a list, but the people who supported the referendum didn't really have, you know, any sort of ability to, as sort of a deterrent, say, well, if you do this to our supporters, we'll do X to your supporters. I mean, I'm not trying to, you know, encourage, you know, public, you know, unrest, but isn't there sort of a, it's not a content-based speech restriction, but it sure does seem to have a bias in it.
It does seem, to some extent, I see what you're talking about. It's almost it's not overt viewpoint discrimination, because it's not the government saying you have to disclose referendum people because we don't like your position. But it is in the sense that anyone who wants to, in the referendum context, anyone who wants to revise an act of the legislature, you have to disclose your information to the public. You have to disclose everything to the public, whereas people who are hunky-dory with what the legislature did not.
Well, I think significantly that's a fairly new interpretation of the Public Records Act in Washington, isn't it?
Yes, it is. The initiatives of referendum have been around in Washington, I think, for over a century, and the Public Records Act first came into being, I think it was 1973, and for over 30 years, up until 2006, the Secretaries of State had interpreted the Public Records Act as not reaching these petition signatures. And in one opinion, Secretary of State opinion, they expressly said the reason for that was because of the chilling effect that this would have on people's willingness to participate in politics. And for that reason, a number of other states, I believe California included, don't make this kind of information public because there's no significant governmental interest that's being furthered to counterbalance the real burden that is being placed on protected speech.
But aren't there the whole variety of practices out there in the states? In fact, many states, of course, do and have for a long time required the disclosure of names on petitions. But I mean, can't you imagine that? States have different levels of the numbers of signatures you should get, or ways in which you should get on the ballot as a candidate, or for a referendum, requiring sometimes going to, you know, getting signatures from all the counties, or getting a certain number of signatures. Shouldn't we allow the state to have some say in, you know, what is this alternative process? We shouldn't think of this in a vacuum. We've got the legislative process, the typical legislative process, and we protect the voter and we make the representative stand up and, you know, say what they're for. And then some places we allow this outlet, this alternative legislative process where the voters have a more direct role. In some states, Maybe some states would consider it more like the way I described it, a nominating process, a place where to show that there's sufficient interest to go around the typical legislative process, you have people, you know, stand up and be counted. And then other places, you know, maybe you're right that Washington State had it right as a policy matter for a long time, that they allow a certain greater anonymity. But why force all the states into the same box to say anytime one has this alternative legislative process, you essentially require it be a kind of an anonymous nominating process to put it on the ballot before the voters can anonymously vote for it?
I think the best response to that is that whether the different states have different disclosure is a legislative judgment. But this is a matter of constitutional law. This is a matter of the Constitution. This is the First Amendment. And what the First Amendment does is it says that there are certain choices that the legislature, states can't make. And in the First Amendment context, it is when the state's procedures will chill speech, particularly core political speech of the kind here. That means that the federal constitution requires that they have a compelling interest to do that, and it can't simply be a matter of a judgment call. States have to have a compelling government interest, and it has to be the most narrowly tailored way to further that interest.
Well, doesn't that? I mean, by describing this as a speech issue, you've sort of assumed away an interesting question that I think John was getting at, which is this could also be understood as an election administration issue, and you know, states get a lot more constitutional discretion to make regulations in election administration than they do in the First Amendment context. So, how can you be so sure that this is in fact a Buckley v. Valeo First Amendment kind of case, and not an Anderson v. Celebrezze, Burdick v. Takushi sort of election administration case like ballot access would be?
The reason for that is that the process of collecting signatures and verifying their signatures is an election administrative process. And no one, we're not arguing that that is illegitimate, that the state doesn't have a proper role, that it can't do that. And if different states want to have different laws about what percentage of the population needs to sign or what information they need to put down so that they can verify that this person actually is who they say they are, that is fine. That's within the state's power. The question, the separate question is whether the disclosure of that information then to the public is justified. And if, for instance, the D.C. Circuit looked in, I think it's AFL-CIO versus Federal Election Commission, about the D.C. Circuit talked about the disclosure of investigatory records at the completion of an investigation. FEC has a practice where they usually disclose all that to the public. They put that out there to the public, and AFL-CIO correctly and persuasively argued that disclosing this information, like you had a proper government interest in getting this information from us, but in order to put that out to the public, you have to show that that satisfies a separate government interest. And the D.C. Circuit said that's right, and the government doesn't have an interest in putting this information out when it would burden your First Amendment rights. Similarly here, while the state of Washington and other states have power to collect this information, the separate question of whether they can then disclose it to the public has to be independently justified under the First Amendment.
Okay.
And we're of the opinion that it can't, they can't meet that burden.
Okay. Well, we're getting close to the end of our time here, and I want to give both of our podcast guests today an opportunity to wrap things up. I'm going to start first with Robert, and then I'm going to give John Fortier the last word. So, Robert.
Thank you, Allison. Anonymous speech has been a vital part of the American political debate since the time of the founding. You know, John Jay, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, the people for which the Federalist Society is largely based upon, wrote the Federalist Papers not in their own names, but as Publius. And they did that, they spoke with that pseudonym in order to persuade their fellow Americans to ratify the Constitution. Now, no one can make you reveal how you voted, as John's pointed out. And likewise, no one should be able to force you to reveal whether you signed a petition or supported a cause before the election. In mandatory disclosure laws of signatories, like Washington State's law, or of contributions to ballot issue committees, as in California and other states, amounts to the government and everyone else peeking into the ballot box. And that's simply contrary to the First Amendment.
Okay, John.
Well, again, I'd like to start by saying I have some sympathy for the role of anonymity, not only particularly in the ballot box, which I'm very sympathetic to, but of course in many cases, or not many cases, I think in certain egregious cases, that you can see the bad effects of having people coerced and people paying some unfair consequences for standing up for something that they believe in. And yet I wonder whether we are painting with too broad a brush to limit all of these disclosures. And I think the states, we should treat the petition process as somewhat of a legislative case outside of the typical legislature, that the states may wish to have a kind of nominating process where people are asked to stand up and be counted to some extent, to put their names on paper and be in favor of putting something on the ballot, at which time everyone would vote anonymously. And while I think there might be some exceptions to this, while one might really look carefully at what the level of signatures is and whether there is this is truly a middle ground where one could say an active, public-spirited group of people should be on record for this. Ultimately, I think that some state discretion in this should be allowed. So I see the value of a state perhaps doing this, and I see some reason for exception, I guess I think we're painting with too broad a brush in this not quite voting and yet not quite representation activity of putting someone on the ballot for nominating for a referendum procedure.
All right, and with that, I would like to thank John Fortier, research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and Robert Frommer, staff attorney with the Institute for Justice, for joining us today on this Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group podcast. And thank you out there for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For related materials to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's webpage at federalistsociety.org/multimedia. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.